Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Beth, and I'll be reading you today's e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, March 4th. We start with the weather and lottery. Well, today and the whole week actually isn't that great, but it is warm. Today, mostly cloudy, high 47. Tomorrow, some rain at times, high 47. Wednesday, some rain at times, a high of 50. And guess what? On Thursday, it's going to be rainy and a high of 45. Here are some lottery numbers from the weekend. First of all, the numbers game, the midday drawing from yesterday, Sunday, March 3rd. The numbers were 1, 5, 5, 3. Last night's daily numbers were 1, 2, 8, 3. Sunday mass cash, 2, 9, 11, 30, and 33. And Saturday night's Powerball numbers, 3, 18, 27, 36, 53, Powerball, 12. Here's our first front page headline today. Hospitals see growing number of patients. Hospitals and healthcare providers on Cape Cod and the islands have seen an increase in patient volume, but are bracing for greater numbers as Steward Healthcare, a for-profit healthcare system, faces grave financial troubles and Governor Maura Healey demands its departure from the state. Healey has called on Steward to complete an orderly transition out of Massachusetts. The system, which operates 30 hospitals across the nation, has acknowledged it is seeking to transfer ownership of its Massachusetts hospitals as it deals with overwhelming debt and financial challenges that threaten its ability to continue operating its 7 active hospitals in the state. Steward Southeastern Mass facilities include Morton Hospital in Taunton and St. Anne's Hospital in Fall River. Anytime a healthcare system closes or reduces service, there's going to be impacts all over the state, including increased demands in the community for care. That's according to Claire Seguin, who's chief nurse and vice president of operations at Martha's Vineyard Hospital. Seguin said since the pandemic, there has been an increase in the volume of patients, causing the facility to expand its services so that patients can avoid ferry trips to Boston to receive care. Our main goal is that patients never really need to go off the island, and so we try to limit that whenever we can by delivering care locally. We have a lot of virtual visits. We can even do urgent care, believe it or not, off hours through the system, said Seguin. The hospital, she said, has the island's only full-service lab. Seguin said the state has helped address a unique challenge around ambulance services, requiring a ferry to transfer patients to a higher level of care off-island. We are very careful stewards of our resources, and we're very careful with our finances, said Amy Lee, who's president and chief operating officer at Nantucket Cottage Hospital. They are investing in technology and educational resources to ensure they provide excellent care to the patients. Lee said Nantucket Cottage Hospital has an average wait time of 15 minutes and has telehealth care so that patients receive care on the island. We have a significant population that is below the poverty line, and to travel off-island for care is cost prohibitive. Both Nantucket Cottage and Martha's Vineyard Hospital are part of the Mass General Brigham system. Being part of that system gives us some strength, said Seguin. That affiliation also relieves some of the stresses faced by other small community hospitals. Community hospitals are facing unprecedented workforce, capacity, and financial pressures that have intensified since the beginning of the pandemic, said Patricia Noga, Vice President of Clinical Affairs at Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association. The same is true so far for Cape Cod Healthcare, which operates 2 hospitals and 6 urgent care centers. We're busy in the acute sector. We're busy in the emergency rooms and urgent care. We're busy everywhere, said Michael Loff, the president and CEO, adding the system is managing the volume of patients well. Community health systems play a vital role in places they serve. Quality health care cannot be limited to large cities and academic medical centers, Loft said. I think community-based health care across our country is in danger. Despite the challenges, he said, the organization continues to meet the demands of the patients. I think our quality is as high as ever, he said. Another story, a Hyannis woman was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison Thursday in connection with a fentanyl distribution conspiracy operating across southeastern Mass and Rhode Island, acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Mass Joshua Levy said in a statement. Rebecca Bartholomew, 37, was also sentenced to 3 years of supervised release during a hearing in federal court in Boston. Bartholomew pleaded guilty in October to conspiracy to distribute and to possess with intent to distribute fentanyl. Bartholomew was one of 10 people indicted by a federal grand jury in August 2022 in connection with the conspiracy. An investigation began in March 2021 into a drug trafficking operation in southeastern Mass and Rhode Island led by Estarlin Ortiz Alcantara. Bartholomew was identified as a distributor. Between April and June 22, Bartholomew redistributed fentanyl she had obtained from Ortiz Alcantara and allegedly other members of the drug trafficking organization, according to the release. During a traffic stop in April 22, Bartholomew had approximately 90 grams of fentanyl in her possession. She's the fourth defendant to be sentenced in the case. Ortiz Alcantara pleaded guilty in December 23 and is scheduled to be sentenced on July 9th. Assistance in the case was provided by the Mass State Police, Homeland Security Investigations, Bristol County Sheriff's Office, and Fall River, Taunton, Attleboro, Scituate, Yarmouth, Providence, Rhode Island, and West Warwick, Rhode Island police departments. And folks digging out from feet of snow in the west this weekend may not believe it, but Thursday was the last day of winter, at least according to meteorologists' record books. According to preliminary data collected by AccuWeather, it was the warmest winter on record in the U.S. when temperatures are averaged out across the entire nation. For statistical purposes, climatologists and meteorologists define winter as the coldest 3 months of the year. Astronomical winter still has a couple of weeks to go, as the spring equinox isn't until March 19th. Indeed, for millions of people in the north central and northeastern U.S., it was the warmest winter season of their lives, upending traditions from sled dog races to ice festivals and spurring on golf matches in Wisconsin and packed playgrounds in Minnesota. It's the year without a winter in the upper Midwest, said AccuWeather chief broadcast meteorologist Bernie Reno. Last week, temps in the U.S., in central U.S., soared into the balmy 70s and 80s, shattering records that had stood for a century or more. Many locations broke temperature records for the month of February. For the winter as a whole, in addition to cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Milwaukee, Des Moines, and Albany, New York, dozens of other locations were also in line to set all-time record warm winters, as final data was still being tabulated Friday. This data is based on the average national temperature ranking for December 1, 2023 through February 29th, compared with all winters since 1893. Cities in the Northeast also recorded a lack of snow due to the warmth. Storms that would usually dump snow brought rain instead. Syracuse, New York recorded a nearly 5-foot snow deficit, the National Weather Service said. Meanwhile, snow did fall in the West, just not as much as hoped. The vital Sierra Nevada snowpack, which normally supplies about a third of California's water when it melts, had a slow start, but it's gotten a bit better. The snowpack's water content Thursday was 80% of normal amounts to date. Meteorologists say El Niño, as predicted last fall, was the primary driver for the warm weather pattern that persisted throughout the winter. El Niño typically produces unusually warm winters across the northern tier of the nation. AccuWeather chief meteorologist John Porter also said that our warming climate also contributed to the unusually mild conditions for much of the country this winter. In a forecast released last week, forecasters at the Climate Prediction Center said the mild trend in the eastern U.S. is expected to continue throughout March, especially in the Great Lakes, Ohio Valley, Mid-Atlantic, and Northeast. The West, however, is predicted to see a cool, soggy March. And this story, the most painful night of the year is almost here. The start of daylight saving time, which subtracts an hour of sleep, is fast approaching. The seasonal time change when we spring forward will occur next week on March 10th, more than a full week before the official start of spring on March 20th. Daylight saving time begins at 2 a.m., when local time will instantly become 3 a.m. Most phones and computers adjust automatically, but manual clocks need to be reset, and it's also a good time to change the batteries in your smoke alarm. Since 2007, daylight saving time has begun on the second Sunday of March and ended on the first Sunday of November. Previously, it started on the last Sunday of April and ended on the last Sunday of October. When daylight saving time begins, we spring forward and lose an hour of sleep as opposed to the November time change where we fall back and gain an hour. This adjustment affects the daily lives of hundreds of millions of Americans, contributing to less sleep in the days following and, of course, later sunsets. And yes, the phrase is daylight saving time, not savings. It's singular no matter how many people around you say it. And contrary to popular myth, daylight saving time was not started to help American farmers. According to timeanddate.com, daylight saving time was first used in 1908 by a few hundred Canadians in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Germany popularized daylight saving time after it first set the clocks forward on April 30, 1916, to save coal during World War I. Daylight saving time became a national standard in 1966 when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Uniform Time Act, which was established as a way to conserve energy. The thinking was, if it's light out longer, that's less time you'll need to use the lights in your house. Presently, Hawaii and Arizona are the only two U.S. states that do not observe daylight saving time. Neither do the U.S. territories of Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, Guam, American Samoa, and Northern Mariana Islands. However, daylight saving time is now used in more than 70 countries worldwide and affects over 1 billion people every year. The beginning and end dates do vary from one country to another. Setting aside the deep philosophical question, the U.S. Department of Transportation is in charge of daylight saving time in all time zones in the U.S. The oversight of time zones was assigned to DOT because time standards are important for many modes of transportation, the department's website says. Recent years have seen a public debate over discontinuing daylight saving time. The U.S. Senate unanimously approved the Sunshine Protection Act in 2022, a bill that would make daylight saving time permanent. However, it did not pass in the U.S. House of Representatives, so the ritual of changing the clock remains. A 2023 version of the bill remained idle in Congress as well. And this headline, plans to build housing on Joint Base Cape Cod under consideration. Members of the Joint Base Cape Cod Military Civilian Community Council said at a Wednesday meeting that they want any housing built on available land at the base to prioritize members of the military and their families stationed there. The Cape's housing shortage spurred state and Massachusetts National Guard officials to propose building housing on the Upper Cape base. We have so many people that serve in our military that need housing, and we can do better on that, Barnstable County Commissioner Mark Forrest said. We have so many people living in southeastern Mass serving in the Coast Guard that are literally living almost in poverty because they have housing problems. During the Wednesday night meeting at the Welcome Center on Cape Edwards, Teresa Park, Deputy Director and Senior Executive Vice President of Mass Development, the state's development finance agency and land bank, gave a presentation about the potential redevelopment of land on the base. Joint Base Cape Cod leaders want to divest extra parcels leased from the state that have been deemed non-essential to base operations. Mass Development was brought on to explore converting the land from military to other uses with a particular focus on housing. The excess land is located on the southern area of the base, where there are existing buildings and two former school sites. The school buildings are under the oversight of the State Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance, which is responsible for capital planning, public building construction, facilities management, and real estate services for Massachusetts. Mass Development is the designated development authority for the Massachusetts National Guard. Christopher Foe, executive director of Joint Base Cape Cod, said the plan is at the proposal stage and money to fund the project has not yet been secured. Some on the council expressed concerns that the housing ultimately built could be used for migrants. When asked if the state could have the authority to change the criteria for who lives in the housing, assuming the project is state-funded, Foe said that everybody in this room needs to make sure that does not happen. We want this to benefit Cape Cod, the citizens of Cape Cod, and the military, he said during the meeting. I'm not going to lie. My priorities will always be the men and women who live and work on Joint Base Cape Cod. The sprawling Joint Base Cape Cod sits on land owned by the state and covers nearly 22,000 acres, or about 30 square miles. The facility is home to four military commands, bases, and stations, including the Army National Guard, Camp Edwards, U.S. Air Force, the Space Force, the Air National Guard, Otis Air National Guard Base, and the U.S. Coast Guard, Air Station Cape Cod. The base is part of the towns of Bourne, Sandwich, and Mashpee, and it borders the town of Falmouth. According to an estimated project timeline from Barrett Planning Group, consultants want to first learn the existing conditions and background of the property before moving toward parcel analysis and planning, which it hopes to complete by spring. Then, they want to have site-specific plans by summer for the state overseeing school sites and another parcel. All the work will culminate in a report and request for proposals issued by fall. Two community engagement meetings will be held with one planned for the spring. We're in the early stages of this project, said Jill Slankis of Barrett Planning Group. It's been a lot of initial outreach to stakeholders, the towns, organizations in the area that would have an interest in really just opening the lines of communication. And this headline called Two Tips to Get Through March, which is written by Cape Cod Times chief photographer Steve Heeslip. He writes, "The longest part of winter, the month of March. A bit of wisdom from Winnie the Pooh might help make the month move along a bit quicker. I always get where I'm going by walking away from where I have been. I've been a fan of the famous bear for a long time. My introduction was made back in 1965 when my mother presented a copy of A.A. Milne's famous book. The inscription in her perfect schoolteacher cursive writes, "To Stevie on his 7th birthday, sorry you have the mumps. Love, Mom and Dad." Yes, I spent the better part of 2 weeks in April that year, sidelined with a swollen neck. Photos from then, my family documented just about everything with a photo, have kept the memory fresh all these years later. Mom did most of the reading as we followed Pooh's adventures through the 100-acre woods. Following the bear's logic, March might just move a bit faster, walking away from gloomy days with the prospect of a brief glimmer of spring to follow. I follow a two-pronged approach to keep the days going. First, keep the bird feeder filled. The entertainment value is worth the price of sunflower seed and a block of suet. This wintertime ritual continues through March at our house, although suet will soon be off the a la carte bird menu. The neighborhood flickers have started to figuratively bite the hand that feeds them. After an early morning suet stop, they take to the gutters and chimney cap, doing their best imitation of Woody the Woodpecker, drumming away in search of a mate. One can tolerate this behavior only so long. I turn paparazzi and chase them with a long lens. Once they find love, we are all happy. Tip number two is a nod to the real days of spring, whenever they finally arrive, starting plants from seed. Every year, hope springs eternal, and the tiny seeds are placed with the utmost care into a cup of soil. As I write, a trio is perched on the windowsill. The sage plant is leaning to the light. Cousins Basil and Thyme are still just above the soil line. By April, the feeder will be dormant, and a few seedlings will be eager for their outdoor debut in May. Most importantly, destination spring is on the horizon, with the long month of March in the rearview mirror. Again, that's a column written by Steve Heaslip, Cape Cod Times chief photographer. This headline, Student Loan Firm Accused of Scheme. A top teachers' union and an advocacy group for student loan borrowers are turning up the heat on one of the country's biggest student loan companies. The American Federation of Teachers and the Student Borrower Protection Center are accusing the company of mismanaging a key student loan program for public service workers and engaging in a call deflection scheme by strategically avoiding borrowers who need help. The groups this week released a trove of internal documents obtained through public information laws from the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority. The student loan company or servicer works with borrowers nationwide. We have ample evidence to show that something rotten is happening in Missouri, said Mike Pierce, the executive director of the Student Borrower Protection Program. The company is calling the accusations false, disingenuous, and nothing more than a PR campaign. It is unfortunate and irresponsible that information is being spun to create a false narrative in an attempt to mislead the public, an MOHELA spokesman said in a statement. We remain committed to helping the millions of student loan borrowers that we serve. The back and forth escalates the fraught relationship between student loan companies and key Democratic constituencies who continue to pressure the federal government to dismantle the student loan system. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is relying on companies like this to help carry out signature debt relief policies in an election year where student loan forgiveness is already playing a big role. The 47-page report published Wednesday provides a glimpse into how one of the country's biggest student loan providers handled the return of bills this fall. Overall, jump-starting the student loan system after the pandemic has been far from simple. A major percentage of borrowers did not pay their bills at all when they first came due. The report suggests MOLA failed these borrowers by confusing them with a Byzantine loop of misinformation and false promises when they called to ask for help. The company's critics say the end goal was to keep borrowers from getting their problems resolved, which would save MOLA money. The Education Department said the Biden administration has made clear it won't let borrowers pay for the failures of student loan companies. In October, the feds issued a $7.2 million penalty to MOLA for failing to send millions of borrowers their bills on time when payments resumed. There are two big allegations the advocacy groups are making. The first involves the Public Service Loan Forgiveness, or PSLF, program. The federal policy allows student loan borrowers who work in public service-oriented jobs, teachers or government employees, for example, to have their loans fully canceled if they've spent a decade responsibly paying them down. MOLA facilitates student loans for all PSLF borrowers. The report says MOLA has profited from a backlog in PSLF applications that the company allowed to explode with nearly 1 million unprocessed forms awaiting officials' attention. It says servicers incorrectly told some borrowers they didn't qualify for the program and inaccurately counted the payment borrowers made to be eligible for full relief. In a joint statement this week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Elizabeth Warren chastised MOLA over the conduct described in the report. Our nation's public servants, members of the military, and first responders deserve far, far better, they wrote. A MOLA spokesperson said the company has doled out $43.8 billion in PSLF loan forgiveness to more than 606,000 borrowers through January of this year. The company says it doesn't have the authority to process relief without authorization from the federal government, which can take a long time. Mola denied it profited from any stalled application. That's nonsense, said Scott Buchanan, the executive director of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, a trade group representing servicers. The report's second major allegation is something it characterizes as call deflection schemes, which it says Mola used to divert borrowers from getting help from customer service reps. The guidance to divert people was part of the company's internal plan, drafted last July, for handling the return to repayment, according to the report. What has happened here is a pattern and practice of greed, said Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers. Mola sees it differently. The company said, ahead of the return to repayment, the education department anticipated a surge in calls and encouraged servicers to find ways to show borrowers how to handle problems on their own. The department confirmed it worked with services to outline strategies to help borrowers find answers to simple problems online rather than by phone. Trying to encourage people who can self-service online is exactly what we should be doing, Buchanan said. Congressional Democrats last week urged the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an oversight arm of the federal government, to follow up on the allegations in the report. A spokesperson for the CFPB declined to comment. In other educational news, this headline, University of Florida eliminates all DEI positions. The University of Florida announced Friday that it is eliminating all diversity, equity, and inclusion employee positions. This change, announced through an emailed memo, comes after the Florida Board of Governors labeled expenditures related to DEI programs as prohibited expenditures. The memo explains that to comply with the Florida Board of Governors Regulation 9.016 on prohibited expenditures, the University of Florida has closed the Office of the Chief Diversity Officer, eliminated DEI positions and administrative appointments, and halted DEI-focused contracts with outside vendors. The Board of Governors defines DEI as any program, campus activity, or policy that classifies individuals on the basis of race, color, sex, national origin, gender identity, or sexual orientation, and promotes differential or preferential treatment of individuals on the basis of such classification. The regulation says a state university may not expend any state or federal funds to promote, support, or maintain any programs or campus activity that violate Section 100 of Florida statutes, advocate for what it defines as diversity, equity, and inclusion, or promote or engage in what it defines as political or social activism. On Friday, Governor Ron DeSantis commented on X, formerly Twitter, DEI is toxic and has no place in our public universities. I'm glad that Florida was the first state to eliminate DEI, and I hope more states follow suit. Employees who have been fired will receive the university's standard 12 weeks of pay. UF said these employees are encouraged to apply between March 1st and April 19th for expedited consideration for different positions currently open at the university. UF also said it will work to speed up the interview process for these employees and provide an answer on all applications within 12 weeks. Democratic State Reps Diane Hart and Yvonne Hinson voiced their disapproval of the firings. I am stunned but not surprised at the elimination of DEI staff at University of Florida, my alma mater, Hinson said. The culture wars engaged in the Republican-dominated Florida House of Representatives will continue until Floridians have had enough and developed the will and determination to flip the majority in the Florida House. Hart called this series of firings the most recent manifestation of the policies of an out-of-touch legislature and a governor's failed presidential bid. When will we stop with these made-up culture wars that are literally costing people their livelihoods? In an effort to prevent indoctrination in our classrooms, we have in turn created an education system that is built off lies, falsehood, and deceptive history. We can't call ourselves the free state of Florida when children aren't free to learn the truth of their history and see the diversity of humanity. The Office of the Chief Financial Officer will reallocate approximately $5 million into a faculty recruitment fund to be administered by the Office of the Provost. These funds were previously reported to Tallahassee for DEI expenses, including salaries and expenditures. UF's diversity dashboard recorded that between fall 2012 and fall 2022, nearly half of students enrolled at the university have been white. In 2012, white students represented 56% out of 28,000 students, and in 2022, 49%. The memo said UF is and always will be unwavering in our commitment to universal human dignity. So we've reached the halfway point of our broadcast, and I will now read today's obituaries. Timothy M. Rose of Harwich, formerly of Holden, passed away on February 19th at the age of 54. Devoted son of Robert Rose and Patricia Christensen. Beloved husband of Amy Rose for 3 years. Loving brother of Brent D. Rose, Richard R. Rose, and Martin J. Rose. Timothy was the dear stepfather to Katie Lynn Anderson and Nicholas Colley, as well as a caring uncle to many nieces and nephews. Timothy was a commercial fisherman and chef for the last 20 years. He was not only an avid fisherman and golfer, but was a top-tier Boston Bruins fan. He will be sorely missed by all of whom had the pleasure of knowing him. A celebration of life will be held on March 6th at the 400 East Restaurant in Harwich from 12 to 3 p.m. And this isn't quite an obit, but it is on the obituary page, and it simply says, "As is a tale, so is a life. Not how long it is, but how good it is what matters." Lucius Seneca. Mark Patrick Robinson, 54, of South Yarmouth, died February 17th in Dennis. For more information, visit HallettFuneralHome.com. Mary Lou K. Coyle of Harwich passed away peacefully while asleep in her home on February 24th. She was 87. She grew up and attended schools in Shelton, Connecticut, raising two children as a single mother until she met the love of her life, Francis Buzz Coyle. Mary Lou and Buzz married in 1976, making their home in Litchfield, Connecticut. Mary Lou was devoted to Buzz. They were inseparable until his death in 2015. Mary Lou is survived by her children, Claire Caskey of Massachusetts, Raymond Caskey of Connecticut, and stepdaughter Jill Coyle of Maine. She is also survived by step-grandchildren and her granddaughters Megan Matajasek and Nicole Matajasek. Visiting hours will be held 9:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. on March 15th at Nickerson Funeral Home, 87 Kroll Road in Chatham, followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. at the Holy Trinity Church on Main Street in West Harwich. The burial will be at 1:45 p.m. at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne. Robert H. Bob Silva, 81, of Hyannis, formerly of Attleboro, passed away on February 28th. He was the cherished husband of Elizabeth Betty Silva, with whom he shared 57 years of marriage. He was the devoted father of Diane Silva Henningsen and her husband Michael of Attleboro and John Silva of Providence. Bob's heart and soul was his beloved granddaughter, Emma Silva Henningsen. He was the brother of Richard Silva and his wife Virginia of San Luis Obispo, California, and Louise Mahoney and her late husband Michael of Falmouth. He is also survived by his sister-in-law Anne Hogland and her husband Michael, as well as many nieces, nephews, and cousins. Visiting hours will be held at the Doan, Beale, and Ames Funeral Home, 160 West Main Street, Hyannis, on Friday, March 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at Our Lady of the Assumption Church on Wiano Ave in Osterville on Saturday, March 9th at 11 a.m. Burial will take place at the Massachusetts National Cemetery on Monday, March 11th at 12:30 p.m. Back to the news, and Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley said Sunday she no longer feels bound by a pledge that's required all GOP contenders to support the party's eventual nominee in order to participate in the primary debates. The Republican National Committee had made the pledge a prerequisite for all candidates, and nearly every major contender signed, except for Donald Trump, the current frontrunner who skipped the debates. When Haley, Trump's lone remaining major challenger for the nomination, was asked on NBC's Meet the Press whether she was compelled to honor that commitment, she said, "No, I think I'll make what decision I want to make." She said the RNC is now not the same RNC as it was at the time of the debates. She also maintained that she has always said she had serious concerns about Trump, for whom she served as UN ambassador. The RNC is in the midst of major changes, with the chair, Ronna McDaniel, set to leave the job on Friday. She was Trump's hand-picked choice to lead the RNC shortly after the 2016 election, but Trump now is poised to install loyalists atop the organization. He has announced his preference for North Carolina GOP chair Michael Whatley, a little-known veteran operative, to replace McDaniel. Trump also has picked his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, to serve as committee co-chair. Haley dismissed questions about whether she would drop out and eventually endorse Trump. "Right now my focus is how do we touch as many voters and how do we win," she said. "I want the American people to see that you don't have to live this way. There is a path forward, and we can do it with someone who can put in 8 years, that can constantly focus on results and not the negativity and the baggage we have right now." Trump on Saturday continued his march toward the nomination, winning caucuses in Idaho and Missouri and sweeping the delegate hall at a party convention in Michigan. Trump's count is now 244 compared with 24 for Haley. A candidate needs to secure 1,215 delegates to clinch the nomination. Next on the Republican calendar was Sunday in the District of Columbia. 2 days later, it's Super Tuesday, when 16 states will hold primaries on the largest day of voting of the year outside of the November election. And a P.S. to this, Nikki Haley did win all the delegate counts in the Washington, D.C. primary this weekend. This headline, life-saving drug revives man 9 times. This is from Columbus, Ohio. Shane Hunter heard a series of muffled noises and indiscernible voices as he drifted in and out of consciousness. He felt groggy, like he was waking up from a nap before rolling over and falling back asleep. Hunter didn't realize it at the time, but he was actually in a dreamlike state, straddling the line between life and death. For Hunter, who was addicted to heroin at the time, it was at least the 9th time he hovered across this macabre threshold over just 5 days in 2018. Each time he had overdosed and was revived with the opioid reversal drug naloxone. "Once I started shooting, it was game over," Hunter, 43, said of his heroin use. "I couldn't stop dying. I was dying all the time." Naloxone saved Hunter's life over and over and over again. But despite serving as a lifeline for people like Hunter for decades, naloxone data remains scant, and it's unclear just how much of the overdose reversal drug gets used or expires without ever being administered. Instead, it's personal stories like Hunter's that have built a case for naloxone as potentially the most critical tool in fighting the opioid epidemic. The lack of data is due in part to the nature of naloxone, experts said. While people who are revived with it are encouraged to head to an emergency department to be evaluated by medical personnel, it's unlikely that everyone does. Ohio's Project Dawn, a network of opioid overdose education and naloxone distribution programs, increased its distribution of naloxone 42% in 2022. That increase in kits led to an 11% jump in known overdose reversals. "Although the data is piecemeal, it still makes a compelling case for naloxone," said Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, who's director of the Ohio Department of Health. and Ohio's efforts must be working, Vanderhoff said, as the number of overdose deaths dropped 5% in Ohio last year to 4,900, while increasing nationally by 1%. It's a challenge because recording a known reversal requires people to tell us that the reversal occurred, Vanderhoff said. Naloxone has become such a key tool in fighting the opioid epidemic that there have been shortages of it. Although it's not Harm Reduction Ohio's primary mission, the nonprofit does try to help people in other states who struggle to get hold of enough naloxone kits. While Ohio's Project Dawn is arguably one of the best in the country, others aren't so lucky. Just a few weeks ago, Harm Reduction Ohio gave a woman from North Carolina 25 expired kits, which studies have shown can still be effective at reversing overdoses and are better than not having naloxone at all. The price of nasal naloxone has come down significantly in the past several years, from around $100 or $80 to $45 per kit, which contains two doses. The FDA helped solve part of the problem in 2023 by making Narcan, the name brand type of naloxone, available to be sold without a prescription over the counter in stores. But some people may be shy about purchasing naloxone at public stores, and at $45 per kit, may also find the overdose reversal drug cost prohibitive. Around Columbus, vending machines with free naloxone aim to alleviate those issues. If it weren't for naloxone, Hunter said he wouldn't be alive today, let alone be entering his sixth year of recovery, and working to help others overcome their addiction at House of Hope in Columbus's Victorian Village. Hunter began taking oxycodone in 2009 after a doctor prescribed it to help him deal with pain from Crohn's disease and inflammation of the digestive tract. It took 2 or 3 years for Hunter to realize he was addicted to the drug and several more to get clean. Even after the opioid epidemic has ravaged parts of Ohio, Hunter said he sees people on Facebook and other social media platforms saying things like, "Addiction is their choice and let them die." He's seen others argue about whether people should be allowed to use naloxone more than 2 or 3 times. And just a little bit of sports news here. 7 Cape Cod teams, 3 basketball and 4 hockey, were in playoff action on Saturday as 6 teams advanced further in the MIAA state tournament for a chance at a state championship. Now in girls basketball, Division 4, round of 32, number 7 Bourne defeated number 26, Southwick Regional, 69-39. In boys basketball, Division 3, round of 32, number 11, Martha's Vineyard, defeated number 22, Linfield, 63-47. In Division 4, round of 32, number 14, Nantucket, 64, versus number 19, Carver, 61. And in boys hockey, Division 4, Sweet 16, number 4 Sandwich defeated number 20 Gardner 6-3. In boys hockey Division 3 Sweet 16, number 1 Nauset 2, number 17 Marlboro 1. And in girls hockey Division 2 Sweet 16, number 2 Falmouth 5, number 15 King Philip 2. And in Division 2 Sweet 16 girls hockey, number 5 Algonquin 3, number 21 Martha's Vineyard 0. The Vineyarders ended up 12-10, and that ended their season in the Sweet 16 on the road. Here's today's Ask Carolyn column. Dear Carolyn, my estranged mother left our family very suddenly 10 years ago when I was almost 14. My dad was and is a workaholic, so the care of my younger sister in the household all fell on me. Though I lost any chance of a normal childhood the day she walked out, things at home had not been good for a while, so there was some relief to having her gone, and I did my best to make life as normal as possible for my little sister. Now our mom is back in our lives, saying she had mental health issues and, with therapy, is ready to be part of our lives again. To my disgust, my dad and sister are welcoming her with open arms. I kind of understand my sister, but I'm surprised and angry that my dad doesn't have more self-respect. My mom and I talked briefly, and she apologized, but I feel like her Sorry I abandoned you, but I had problems. Doesn't make up for me having to grow up overnight. Everybody has an opinion on this. My boyfriend is telling me to keep her out of my life, while my father and sister say it's healthier for me to let go of my anger and forgive her. How do I get through this? She and my dad seem to be reuniting. Signed, Angry. Dear Angry, wait. Why is your dad off the hook? A sick parent leaves and the healthy co-parent watches his older child shoulder an inappropriately heavy burden and does nothing to stop it? Maybe you skipped over his role, but still, he was the well parent and spouse, so your misery is not 100% your mom's fault. Forgiveness is healthier for you than anger, of course, but it's not a light switch. It's a process. Counseling would at least give you support from someone without an agenda, and at best, an informed guide. You went through a difficult, painful, and unjust struggle just as you were hitting your adolescence. That means bringing your adult perspective to your youthful one will probably be a layered process, where you address not only your mom's choices, but also the context of the absentee husband/dad and your own thwarted adolescence. And the boundary issues of everyone coaching you on how to feel now, it's a lot. Maybe respect your instinct to keep your distance and use the space you create to let therapy do its thing. And here is some of what's on television tonight. The Food Network at 8 p.m. has the season premiere of the Spring Baking Championship. A dozen bakers are put to the test to transform springtime soirees into spectacular desserts. From Earth Day and Jazz Fest to Derby Day and more, the bakers must whip up the most delectable edible creations to win $25,000. On Fox at 8 p.m., the season premiere of MasterChef Junior. Young home cooks compete in a series of challenges to win the title of America's next MasterChef Junior, taking home a trophy and $100,000. And Fox at 9 o'clock, it's So You Think You Can Dance. It's the season premiere of that. This dance competition series has a new format reflecting the authentic experience of building a successful career in dance. And on NBC at 10 p.m., there's new episodes of Deal or No Deal Island. Following its premiere last week, this new game show moves to its regular time slot starting tonight. Joe Manganiello hosts the spin on the classic Deal or No Deal game, where 13 players are transported to the banker's private island to compete for cash in a season-long, fully immersive competition. And on Nat Geographic Channel at 8 p.m., there's a new series. Oscar-nominated actress Angela Bassett narrates this exciting new documentary series focusing on female leaders among the animal kingdoms. It's called Queens, and it highlights the sacrifices and challenges various matriarchs of different species must endure for the survival of their families, as well as their resilience, intelligence, and ability to love those around them. Again, that's on Nat Geo at 8 p.m. And Netflix has a new series starting today based on the classic Hot Wheels toys. This high-octane animated kid series follows the newest generation of drivers as they experience mind-blowing races, extreme stunt contests, and thrill-seeking challenges. That's called Hot Wheels Let's Race, and it's on Netflix. In some other news, from Austin, Texas, Houston resident Elizabeth Francis has lived a long time, long enough to see the end of Jim Crow laws, the Civil Rights Act signed into law, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the fall of the Soviet Union, and the first black president to be elected. Francis was born in Louisiana on July 25th, 1909. At 114 years of age, Francis is the oldest living person in the U.S., according to LongevaQuest, a nonprofit that accounts for human longevity around the globe. According to the Gerontology Research Group, Francis is also the fifth oldest supercentenarian, a person who lives to be 110 years old, in the world. Francis grew up in Louisiana with her five siblings. After the passing of her mother, she was sent to Houston to live with her aunt. She worked at ABC 13 News in Houston, where she operated a coffee shop until her retirement in 1975. In 1928, she gave birth to her only daughter, Dorothy Williams, who is now 94 years of age and who she shares a home with. Her granddaughter, Ethel Harrison, who is also her primary caregiver, said Frances had offered valuable life advice over the years. "Treat people like you want to be treated," she said. Harrison also mentions that Frances was a woman of routine. She never learned how to drive, so she often took the bus, and she liked to walk. She also grew her own vegetables. Harrison said her grandmother's lifestyle was a major part of her longevity. Her life was always pretty simple: early to bed, early to rise, work hard, then come home and make a nutritious meal and be with family. Frances had to start using a wheelchair at 108 years of age. When asked by a reporter how old she is, Frances joked, "I'm very, very young. Look at me, I'm like a little young chicken." In July, Frances celebrated her 114th birthday with loved ones. According to LongevaQuest, Frances was given a Texas-sized plaque with the title Oldest Living Texan. And this story, a Supreme Court decision could come as soon as today in the case about whether former President Donald Trump can be kicked off the ballot over his efforts to undo his defeat in the 2020 election. Trump is challenging a groundbreaking decision by the Colorado Supreme Court that said he is disqualified from being president again and ineligible for the state's primary, which is Tuesday. The resolution of the case on Monday, a day before Super Tuesday contests in 16 states, would remove uncertainty about whether votes for Trump, the leading Republican candidate for president, will ultimately count. Both sides had requested fast work by the court, which heard arguments less than a month ago on February 8th. The Colorado court was the first to invoke a post-Civil War constitutional provision aimed at preventing those who engaged in insurrection from holding office. Trump also has since been barred from primary ballots in Illinois and Maine, though both decisions, along with Colorado's, are on hold pending the outcome of the Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court has, until now, never ruled on the provision, which is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The court indicated Sunday there will be at least one case decided Monday, adhering to its custom of not saying which one. But it also departed from its usual practice in some respects, heightening the expectation that it's the Trump ballot case that will be handed down. Except for when the end of the term nears in late June, the court almost always issues decisions on days when the justices are scheduled to take the bench. But the next scheduled court day is until March 15th. And apart from during the coronavirus pandemic when the court was closed, the justices almost always read summaries of their opinions in the courtroom. They won't be there Monday. Any opinions will post on the court's website beginning just after 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday. Separately, the justices last week agreed to hear arguments in late April over whether Trump can be criminally prosecuted on election interference charges, including his role in the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The court's decision to step into the politically charged case, also with little in the way of precedent to guide it, calls into question whether Trump will stand trial before the November election. The former president faces 91 criminal charges and 4 prosecutions. Of those, the only one with a trial date that seems poised to hold is his state case in New York, where he's charged with falsifying business records in connection with hush money payments to a porn actor. That case is set for trial on March 25th, and the judge has signals his determination to press ahead. And for you Trader Joe's fans out there, more than 61,000 pounds of steamed chicken soup dumplings sold at Trader Joe's are being recalled for possibly containing hard plastic, U.S. regulators announced Saturday. The Agricultural Department's Food Safety and Inspection Service noted that the now recalled dumplings, which are produced by the California-based CJ Foods Manufacturing Beaumont Corporation, may be contaminated with foreign materials, specifically hard plastic from a permanent marker pen. The recall arrives after consumers reported finding hard plastic in the Trader Joe's branded products. To date, no related illnesses or injuries have been reported. FSIS urged consumers to check their freezers. The 6-ounce Trader Joe's steamed chicken soup dumplings under recall were produced on December 7, 2023, and can be identified by their side box labels with lot codes 0.03.0725. In an online notice about the recall, Trader Joe's asked consumers to throw the impacted dumplings away or return them to any store location for a full refund. A spokesperson for CJ Foods Manufacturing Beaumont Corporation told the AP that the company was investigating the issue, which happened during the manufacturing process. In an emailed statement, the food maker added that customer safety remains number one priority. Foreign object contamination is one of the top reasons for food recalls in the U.S. today. Beyond plastic, metal fragment, bits of bugs, and more extraneous materials have prompted recalls by making their way into packaged goods. Some people in the news. Pharrell Williams helped Miley Cyrus shed her Hannah Montana persona on her climb to music stardom. The Doctor collaborators appeared on the Zane Lowe Show to promote the new single, which was 10 years in the making. The duo first wrote Doctor a decade ago, and according to Cyrus, a newly minted Grammy winner for her single Flowers, Pharrell helped her transition from Disney Channel darling to Grammy-winning global superstar. "He was kind of the only one. I knew that everyone around me would tell me no, and he was the only one that I asked, what did he think?" Cyrus told Lowe, according to Billboard, and he was like, "Go for it today, tomorrow, as soon as you can. That sounds like the perfect thing to do." Pharrell added that Cyrus was in a place where no one really understood where she was, and I got it. And a private plane carrying singer, Carol G, made an emergency landing at a Los Angeles airport Thursday night. The aircraft carrying the Grammy winner and others landed at Van Nuys Airport around 9 p.m. with no immediate reports of injuries. The plane left Hollywood Burbank Airport with 16 people and flew east, but turned around when the pilot reported smoke in the cockpit, KABC reported. The cause of the malfunction was not immediately known. Carol G won her first Grammy and was named Billboard Magazine's 2024 Woman of the Year in February. The Colombian singer-songwriter is expected to be honored at the Billboard Woman in Music Awards on Wednesday. And a federal judge told veteran investigative reporter Catherine Herridge in civil contempt last week for refusing to divulge her source for a series of Fox News stories about a Chinese-American scientist who was investigated by the FBI but never charged. U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper in Washington imposed a fine of $800 per day until Herridge reveals her source, but the fine will not go into effect immediately to give her time to appeal. And that's all the time I have for today. This is your reader, Beth, saying thank you for listening and thank you for your continued support of the Audible Local Ledger.